It's the ERP Confab. I'm David Essex, industry editor at Search SAP, with my colleagues, news editor Jim O'Donnell and Brian McKenna, business applications editor at Computer Weekly. SAP is celebrating its 50th birthday this year. A pioneer of ERP in 1972, it has adapted to rapid changes in technology, vastly expanded its product line, and fended off fierce competition to become Europe's largest tech company. How did SAP do it? What could it have done better? And what might the next 50 years hold? We'll ask our guest, Vinny Merchandani, a longtime industry analyst and author of three books about SAP. Vinny, thanks for being here, first of all. It's unusual for a tech company to last 50 years. How do you think SAP has managed to do it and not only survive, but become the largest tech company in Europe?
You know, I would say you're right. I mean, it is remarkable they've survived 50 years and they're still at the top of the game, right? I would say they've evolved the product, right? They moved from mainframe R2 to R3 on the client server format, and evolved R3 to ECC, different versions of that. They bought a bunch of cloud properties, so they got their feet wet in the cloud area, and now they have their own cloud offerings. And increasingly, they're evolving into the network economy. You know, we've all heard about Riva and Concur and so on, but they're doing a lot of vertical networks. There's one like Catena X, which is for the auto industry. They're a vital part of that very big auto industry that's evolving. So I think they've done a good job evolving product-wise. I think their management teams, if you look at the last 50 years, every 5 or 6 years, they do a refresh. People say, oh my God, what's going to happen? It's chaos, it's going to be chaos and so on. Yeah, they have some chaos for a few months, but they seem to just settle in with the new management team. So I think that's been a big difference compared to some of the other, you know, companies that have lasted 50 years, but I think their management transitions have been a little more chaotic, I would say. And I think the customer base has been somewhat loyal, but not loyal for just the sake of being loyal. SAP has given them a lot of very reliable solutions. It's been rock solid in a number of areas, right? To some, in a degree, that's negative because it tends to make the SAP customer base somewhat IT-centric, somewhat cautious. They tend to have that kind of a customer base. But on the other hand, hey, 50 years from a CFO's perspective, my God, that is one hell of a recurring revenue stream to keep leveraging.
So if we could maybe jump to one of the, I think, big challenges they're going through, and that's the migration, S/4HANA. You talk to a lot of customers for your books. So I'm wondering, of the ones that are reluctant to move to S/4HANA, what seems to be holding them back?
You know, when you look at ERP when it came out, or when I was at Gartner in the late 90s, right? ERP, the goal was, hey, we're going to replace pretty much 70-80% of our custom applications, legacy applications with ERP. Now, I would say in a number of industries, it's down to 20%, right? So we forget that people have a lot of different priorities, a lot of new areas, new innovation areas, edge applications, and so on. Upgrading your ERP is not as important as us analysts, as us observers seem to think it is. So these transitions take a decade, 2 decades. I mean, I'm looking at Infor, for example. When they're still talking about Lawson and Intentia and Bond, these are products from the 1980s, right? If you look at Oracle, and they still haven't migrated a bunch of PeopleSoft or Siebel customers to their Fusion. So I think you've got to put it in that context. So SAP, if anything, the ECC guys have been around for 20 years, but a number of them are more recent. I think it's not high priority for a number of customers. Partly the cost of migration. You know, this is an SAP weakness. They've tended to rely a lot more on system generators. And so the cost of migration tends to be a little bit more expensive than that of other vendors. And then, you know, what ROI do you get from just upgrading your back office? The ERP tends to be back office. You know, I mean, like I said, there's a lot more priorities, a lot higher value realization areas in the R&D labs, in the warehouse. And I mean, there's so many areas that we need to automate. And there, you know, there's new forms of automation, robotics, RPA, et cetera, et cetera. There's so much technology to apply that I'm not surprised that people, don't necessarily jump up and down and say, I got to move to S/4HANA tomorrow.
How serious do you think SAP is about rewriting its ERP for multi-tenant SaaS specifically? And how would you say that effort compares with what Oracle's been doing?
Again, this is inside baseball. You and I are fascinated. You talk to analysts all the time and talk about multi-tenancy. You know, SAP has a product called BYD, which is multi-tenant. There's a very purist group of technocrats who will say, I'll only buy a multi-tenant cloud solution. But the definition of cloud has become looser and looser. You know, people are going with hyperscalers, people are doing private cloud. So I think that's a religious argument that many of us can spend hours on. Mm-hmm. I think customers are a lot more pragmatic. You know, multi-tenancy, SAP's tried. They've gone to some industries and say, hey, we'll build a multi-tenant version of industry functionality. And some industries say, fine. Others will say, no, my God, no, I'll never be able to get past my regulators. I'll never be able to, I don't want to share my, you know, whatever, even basic rack with my competitors and so on. So I think multi-tenancy, clearly from an architectural perspective, makes a lot of sense. It's a shared service. You get common upgrades. I mean, there's a lot of positive to multi-tenancy. But from a practical perspective, customers just, you know, have to balance their own risk assessments and their concerns with the architectural purity.
You know, we've talked a lot about in the past about what SAP has been doing with their customer base and the transition from S/4HANA. Do you think that they've done enough to really help their customers through such a major transition? And also sort of related, do you think that such a major transition has opened up SAP to vulnerability, you know, that maybe their customers are going to look at other systems when they have to sort of weigh that kind of major transition that they have to make?
I don't think they're very vulnerable because the competition has nowhere near the breadth of functionality or vertical depth. So even if they wanted to, they would be better off than going with their best of breed, pick and choose here and there and so on. If they want an integrated suite, I don't think SAP is much competition. So I don't think they've been that threatened from that perspective. Yeah, they'll lose a few here and there because of M&A or, you know, strategic direction changes or whatever. I don't think they've lost too many. And sorry, what was your first question was, has SAP done enough?
Yeah.
So my preference would have been they automated a lot more of the migration, right? But the more I talk to people, especially when they're doing digital transformations around S/4HANA, they go, I don't want the past come forward. I really have to rethink my processes. I prefer to do a greenfield. It'll be a lot more pain, but I'll be able to get new master file definitions. I'll be able to get a lot more process reengineering done. Yes, people who want to just move for the sake of doing a technical migration, it'd be nice if SAP and other vendors didn't just say, go have an integrator do it for you. I'd like both SAP and the integrators to have a lot more migration tools, testing tools that are a lot more automated and so on. But that honestly just bakes the old legacy thinking into the new application. I've myself gone through the evolution where I go, it may not be that right, given all the changes that the companies are going through.
What do you think of the Rise with SAP program as, you know, that vehicle to move, you know, the customer base? Or do you think that's more for, as you said, the greenfield implementers?
Every customer that I talk to, they're thinking about different business models. Not because they want to, it's because their competitors are forcing them to, their customers are forcing them to, right? So take an example in the industrial sector. A lot of the product companies have been moving to what's called servitization. They're selling a lot more services, post-sale services. It could be maintenance, it could be subscription-based stuff, outcome-based contracts, and so on. Because customers are saying, look, I'm tired of paying you on an annual basis when my volumes are variable. You know, so Rolls-Royce sells power by the hour, right? It's tied to what the customer is using, consuming, making revenues on. So I think SAP is getting the same pressure, which is, you know, I'm tired of paying you a fixed cost every year, aligned with my outcomes, right? So Rise is a starting point in rethinking the business models, making it more consumable and so on. It's a long way from outcome-based, tied to what the customer results are, right? But it's a start. That's the way I see Rise. It is a big, messy portfolio of offerings because it's not only SAP products. They've also thrown in the hyperscalers in there. They've also thrown in the system integrators in there and so on. But I think it's a step in the right direction, moving the business model towards closer to where the customer's business models are.
Yeah, RISE, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I'm not entirely convinced they're wedded to the term. I mean, the rational core of it is it's about making the cloud transition easier for their customers. That does make sense, even if it is messy and they're throwing a whole bunch of other stuff in there and maybe they won't stick with RISE forever. I mean, we all know what happened to Leonardo as a term or C4HANA as a term. I mean, these, you know, they are quite quick to drop these terms if they're not particularly useful to them. But the core idea of you know, getting beyond just selling tech and getting towards selling outcomes for customers, I mean, that does seem to make an awful lot of sense. But I suppose it'd be interesting to get your take on this, Vinny. There is a danger, isn't there, for SAP, not that that should concern us unduly, that if you're offering business transformation as a service, you're kind of implying that you can do everything. And I've certainly spoken to SAP executives who do, without naming them, they do have that concern themselves that, yeah, we seem to be offering everything and we can't.
You know, it becomes a case of when you go in as a consortium, right? And SAP has always gone in with the Accentures, the hardware players, database players. You know, it was a pure application vendor when it started off. So ECC ran on Oracle, ran on Sybase, ran on a whole bunch of databases. Mm. It was one of the most open ecosystems, Accenture, Deloitte, IBM, everybody, right? So they've always been used to going in as a consortium to customers. But more and more SAP customers have turned to SAP and say, I want you. You're my core. You're the reason all the other guys become part of my architecture, become part of my vendor community, and so on. I want you to lead a number of areas. So SAP actually has been grudging about that. They know what they're good at. They know what they're not that good at. They're good at creating code. They're not as good at operating code, right? And they learn through the cloud that you can't just throw code over and let customers worry about it. You got to monitor it. You got to manage it, and so on. They've become better at that. But, I mean, look, when I talk to customers, the changes that are going on today, not just in IT, just in the business, right? Think about the last 6-7 years. They've gone through digital transformations. They've had climate change and sustainability issues bombard them. COVID came along. Ukraine came along. They've gone through supply chain disruptions. They've gone through great resignation. Customers are just, this is a very different customer than it was just 6-7 years ago. Right? We tend to be myopic and focused on what is SAP doing. I look at it and say, what is a community of customers doing and where does SAP fit in that? And I think SAP struggles to keep out actually with the customer changing customer expectations, but they're doing better than other vendors. I talk to other vendors and it's still stuck in the back office. They have no clue what is happening in the labs when it comes to emissions or, you know, when it comes to product design, when it comes to sustainable design and so on, no clue. They have no clue that consumer product companies are aggressively looking at direct-to-consumer, bypassing retailers, right? I mean, these are all massive changes that are going on in industries that SAP is actually savvy about that other vendors don't even know or don't have the curiosity to find out what's going on.
That sounds very cogent, Penny. There is this perception, though, isn't there? Maybe more among financial analysts and financial reporters, that SAP historically has been a laggard when it comes to the cloud, that it seems to have been spurred into action by the rise of the hyperscalers, AWS, GCP, Azure, etc. It's reacting to them and reacting to financial analyst and investment type questions concerning that.
I think that's a little unfair. I mean, BYD was first imagined, didn't come out till the early 2010, but it was imagined starting in 2007, 2008. Okay.
Yeah.
The cloud properties they acquired, Ariba, SuccessFactors, Concur, et cetera, et cetera, they've been learning about cloud, how to manage cloud applications for a decade now. So, I mean, clearly the hyperscalers, just because they are so much bigger and have so much power, have forced SAP to say, okay, I shouldn't be doing this as myself. I should be working with them. They have a lot more, you know, they'll have 50 times more compute power than I can ever think of investing in, right? So they've learned that that has accelerated it. But I think it's an unfair statement that SAP doesn't understand the cloud or came in very, very late.
Yeah. And that's why they're working now hand in glove with the hyperscalers. But there is Vinny, you know, the likes of Workday and who you know very well and Salesforce as well. It was an option for SAP to be more cloud delivered, if you like, earlier, I suppose would be the argument. Now that may not matter now. That just simply may not matter anymore. But before the hyperscalers, there was NetSuite, there was Workday, there was Salesforce.
Well, so I look at it as bidirectional. If you go back to 2010, yes, the Workdays, the NetSuites, the Salesforces, ServiceNows had the opportunity to just become the next SAP, become the next Oracle. But they chose not to, or they tried to, and they couldn't verticalize. I mean, they still are 20 years after NetSuite was born in the late 90s, 25 years now. Cloud applications only make up 20% of the enterprise. They haven't grown functionally enough. They do a great job in finance or HR or, you know, core ERP, CRM. But, you know, you look at industry functionality, every industry has two or three, four major books of record. Insurance has claims and policies. You know, banking has core banking. Every industry has unique transaction systems and master files and so on. Show me the cloud solutions here. Show me what Workday has delivered there. Show me what Salesforce has delivered there, right? So that was one direction. So they haven't exactly grown to the size of the opportunity. And your point is SAP should have moved quicker into the cloud. And yes, you're right. They should have started 2007. Gone into HR and finance and probably killed us Workday back in 2010. But, you know, I don't think they're doing too badly. SuccessFactors and, you know, some of the other applications, give them a fairly, I mean, if you look at, especially the Ariba's and Concur's and so on, I forget the number now, but $3 or $4 trillion of commerce flows through those engines. These are massive engines.
SAP has deep roots in Germany, is based there. Biggest global market region is EMEA. North America is a close second. And for a number of years, many years, SAP has had American CEOs or co-CEOs and Bill McDermott and Jennifer Morgan, and is always keen to try to grow its market share here. Do you think being a German company has hurt SAP's appeal in North America in any way, made it hard for it to expand? Or maybe is it the opposite? It's actually helped SAP because it's perceived as one of these sort of superior German engineering brands like BMW or Mercedes-Benz.
Well, you know, so the US, maybe stupidly so, we are the most friendly to foreign products, trade, and so on. Unfortunately, we end up running massive deficits as a result. But, you know, we're China's biggest market, we're India's biggest market. All these emerging market countries, we are their biggest single market, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't think SAP would have been discriminated against because it was not an American company. Mm-hmm. It's a very merit-based marketplace we have here. And SAP clearly, when it entered in the early 90s, was given a better than equal shot for, you know, a startup. Back then, it was a startup for the US market and took advantage of it. So I don't think that being a German company has hurt it too much in the North American market, partly because the verticals it went after, chemicals, oil and gas, auto, and so on, just didn't find alternatives, U.S. alternatives, that could provide it much competition. I, you know, worry sometimes. SAP has a very, very, you know, as we look at the next generation of sustainability, energy, and so on, Germany finds itself in a very unique position. Again, historically, you know, after the 1970 oil shocks, every one of the European countries had to wake up and go, we don't have much oil, we don't have much gas, we don't have much coal, what do we do, right? France chose to go nuclear, Norway chose to go hydroelectric, Iceland and geothermal, Germany said we will bet a lot on wind and solar. And so they're very, still continue to be very hot on renewables. And their EV market, electrical vehicle market, their automakers are really, really hot on the EV market. Between Germany and China, they're poised to dominate the world EV market. So that perspective kind of clouds their view on why that's route for every market. So they will look at the US often and say, I mean, you guys are unbelievably focused on oil and gas. That's the energy of the past. Well, it works for us, right? We can't exactly throw away our energy independence and just go with what's fashionable, right? So I think SAP sometimes is not as sensitive to what works for them doesn't work for many other countries. I mean, they even look at, I talked to some of the folks in Germany and they'll go, the French are idiots. Nuclear is so dangerous. Why? How is it dangerous? It's worked for them just fine, right? In fact, they're in a better position post-Ukraine in terms of energy independence compared to Germany. I think that is where some of the geopolitical angles come in. SAP is really hot on sustainability. Well, in Asia, sustainability is just not that hot an issue. In North America, it is, but not quite as much as in Europe. So sometimes they need to tone it down depending on what industry they're talking to, what geography they're talking to, and so on. I think they're a very savvy global company. It's amazing how many companies, I mean, they're present in 120 countries now. Somebody was telling me they have retailers in 120 countries, retail customers, 16,000 customers in 120 countries, just in the retail sector. I can't think of any other vendor that has anywhere near that level of depth by country.
SAP executives, Bill McDermott used to say this all the time, it's a truly global company in a way which some of its peers, he would have argued, are simply not. So yeah, that's a super interesting point. It's very interesting also that it is a German company because it's the only kind of big IT company I can think of that is not American. That is pretty unusual. I mean, can you think of any other European company that's got anything like serious heft?
Siemens does. I mean, if you look at the auto companies, they've done.
Yeah, but IT. I mean, I can think of IFS.
Okay, if you leave it from an application perspective, no.
Yeah.
Or a software perspective, no. Software AG is a very, very distant second from that perspective. No. SAP has done very well.
It has done very well, and it's very central to the German economy and German political life and so on. Jim's 50th anniversary piece for TechTarget has got a picture with the SAP executive team, and included is Olaf Scholz, who's, you know, the Chancellor of Germany, SPD Chancellor. It's a big deal for the German economy and the German political class.
Brian, I understand that you had some thoughts about how the sustainability push that SAP has, how that might play out in German politics versus the US.
Yeah, I think Vinny was very much addressing that, weren't you, about the way that they maybe have to couch the rhetoric a little bit so that sustainability message can land more effectively in the US as opposed to Europe and also as opposed to Asia. I thought that was a very interesting point you made there about Asia.
I mean, you know, my point to SAP is you tend to rely a lot more on compliance and legal pressure to sell products. With Sarbanes-Oxley 10 years ago, it's sustainability now, ESG reporting and so on. I'm much more about show people how to make money, reduce costs to make money, and they will gladly adopt your product. When you have the government forcing it down their throat or some activist group pushing it down their throat, people grudgingly adopt that. So, you know, I mean, to some extent, SAP's got to become better at showing how sustainability is going to generate revenues. Now, I've talked to some of their customers. Some of their customers, chemical company customers, are moving into molecular recycling. That's a way to make money. There are fashion companies that are making money from recycled products and all that. You know, so the business models are emerging, giving circular economy trends and so on, to show you can make money. And SAP needs to become better at positioning, hey, look, this is not just because some government wants you to do it. it's good for the planet, it's good for people and so on, but you can also make money doing it, right? When they get that message right, I think it'll start selling in the US a lot more. Asia is a little bit of a different, you know, I mean, I don't see the same level of concern there. I mean, China and India continue to have just use coal-fired plants like it doesn't matter, right? So I think that's a little more difficult market when it comes to sustainability messaging.
What's the only other thing that we could maybe discuss very briefly is the Ukraine war. And because SAP, as a German company in terms of its headquarters, is culturally and geographically closer to that than even we are in the UK. There's always only a small bit of SAP's revenue anyway. They seem to be taking any losses more or less on the chin. Do you think it is significant, Vinny, because SAP was a big supplier in Russia?
A couple of things. When it started, there was a lot of focus on sanctions and who's trying to evade them and so on. But SAP's exposure compared to the oil, if you look at BP's exposure or Shell's exposure and so on, was minute. So right. I think in the overall scheme of things, it wasn't that big. And honestly, now we're starting to see, hey, look, maybe the sanctions are backfiring against the West. You guys are in the UK are going to see pretty harsh winter coming up, right? Right. Yeah, you got to be careful, right? I mean, I don't want to encourage Putin. I mean, what he did was absolutely despicable. But you step back and you go, are we hurting ourselves in the process? And I think we are to some extent.
I think when we talked before, you did mention, and this kind of goes back to what you said a little bit earlier in the conversation about their management transition and their leadership transitions over the years. And right now, currently, you know, I think they have, you might have said it yourself, that they have, if not the youngest, amongst the youngest leadership teams in IT and enterprise technology. So how do you think that positions themselves for the future? You know, is that, will, are they really bringing in the type of leaders that can make that transition into areas like sustainability that maybe they're, where they're focusing their growth on?
I think the younger managers, executives in SAP are very, very savvy about sustainability, almost too much, right? It's a passion. But what I like is they still have a lot of gray hair. Peter Meyer, who runs Ferry Industries, for example, you know, he's a 30-year veteran of SAP. So they have a nice mix of the younger generation. I think I commented to you that Christian Klein, I've heard from customers say, boy, it's so nice to deal with the millennial CEO. Such a different perspective, right? I don't think you get that from many of the other companies. Even though they may have young executives, they've been there since their 20s. And so, yeah, it just doesn't come through. That freshness doesn't come through. So I think SAP, certainly from a management perspective, looks very open, young, enthusiastic, and so on. I mean, like I said, they get carried away with some of the sustainability passion and so on, but I'd rather have a group of passionate people, you know, young, energetic.
Do you think that, you know, getting back to a little bit of the German side of it too, you know, they're not coming from Silicon Valley, which is where a lot of the center of gravity is, and, you know, in the IT industry, do you think that makes a difference as far as that leadership point of view goes?
I was talking to a VC last week, and he said, you know, technology has become part of the fabric of every industry. So I think the Silicon Valley advantage 10 years ago has kind of gotten diffused. I mean, if you look at Volkswagen setting up a 10,000 software engineer group to convert them from a engineering hardware centric culture to a software driven culture, that's happening over and over again in so many industries. You know, Silicon Valley is very good at certain things, right? Consumer tech, they've clearly been dominant when it comes to anywhere in the world. Enterprise tech found in the last 10, 15 years, they've become more cautious. They're more into smaller investments in specific parts of the enterprise. I don't think they're that visionary. They're not that influential as they used to be. Technology is becoming part of the fabric of every industry. So, you know, the customers themselves are building their own centers of excellence, embedding so much technology into their products that I think what they are looking for from their application vendors has evolved quite a bit. So I don't think in that sense SAP is at a disadvantage because it's not anywhere near Silicon Valley. I would say it's actually closer to its customers than many other vendors.
Vinny, where do you see SAP going in the next 50 years, if you could hazard a guess in terms of innovation and business trends that might drive them forward?
So I've had a chance to work with them for the last few months on a project called Business as Unusual. And it kind of had its origins on, hey, look, all these shocks that companies have had between digital transformations and COVID and Ukraine and climate change and supply chain disruptions and the great resignations and so on. These are not recognizable companies compared to even 7-8 years ago. Industries are blending so much. I mean, you know, you look at retailers, for example, curbside check-in, last mile delivery, and so on. We couldn't imagine a retailer doing that 5 years ago. They managed to do it in a month, right? You look at it, healthcare, telemedicine. I mean, every industry has dramatically changed in the last few years. What I'm finding is SAP is actually, given its vertical strengths, able to move to these edge applications, these new applications, a lot quicker than any of the others. So that's been very healthy to see. I'm hearing from them a real focus on verticals that were lost for the last decade. The last decade to me, SAP was first HANA, then S4. So very horizontal, very technology, and then horizontal application focused. I'm seeing a resurgence in let's get back to verticals, and let's get back to verticals from many different perspectives. You know, let's build networks that are industry specific. Let's build edge applications. That to me is exciting. That could be the next 10, 15 years of SAP in different industries, which frankly are ripe for a new thinking. They've changed so much. And a number of the other vendors just go to them and try to sell them general ledgers and payroll. That didn't change. Everything has changed around me. I'm trying to go direct to consumer if I'm retail. I'm trying to do telemedicine if I'm healthcare. I'm trying to do electrical vehicles if I'm an automaker. I've got to think about if I'm a utility, I've got to think about decentralized electricity markets as people generate their own electricity. They become what's called prosumers. It's a completely different set of industries. And I think SAP is pretty well positioned for many of them. Now, because they lost a decade, it's not a given that SAP is going to be successful in all these industries. But they're certainly positioned, they certainly have the understanding of these industries better than other vendors to be able to make that impact. The other thing I've seen as part of this project is the ecosystem at SAP used to be primarily the systems integrators, right? Mm. Accentures, the Deloitte's and so on. I have in this project met with strategy firms, the McKinsey's, the Bain's, and so on, that are shaping how people kick off their long-term digital transformations, and SAP is very close to them. I've seen something called the SAP.io Foundries. It's kind of an accelerator. They've had 300 or 400 startups go through that in the last 6 or 7 years. Really, really focused startups that SAP is learning to leverage. I've seen SAP make some nice investments like Feather, which is focused on retail returns, re-commerce and retail. Green Token, which is helping people look at what's called mass balancing in chemical. You know, when you have different molecules from different sources, how do you track if a certain thing is truly, you can consider something truly green, or is it polluted in some way? There's a new, I call it the new medicine, new energy, new mobility, new business models. And SAP is squarely at the edges of every one of these changes that's happening. That's pretty exciting.
But you know, it's very, very interesting, because I remember we had this same conversation about 5 or 6 years ago. And you were saying, well, you know, if Bill McDermott was talking to McKinsey, what would he say? He would have nothing to say to them. So that is a definite shift in perception from your point of view.
To some extent, it's been the strategy firms have realized they need to become more technologically savvy.
Right.
So their digital practices have evolved. And SAP has realized that they need to get closer to the strategy firms too. I mean, the ecosystem, strategy firms, it's these foundry startups.
Yeah.
A lot of industrial companies, robotic companies, a lot of last mile delivery partners. I mean, the ecosystem is massive right now. They don't talk enough about it, but it's massive right now.
I remember that conversation that we had very distinctly. And what you're saying now definitely marks a shift in perception from what you were saying then. So that indicates that SAP is changing in a direction that you were advocating.
They were very comfortable with the systems integrators and outsourcers. That group they were comfortable with. They were not as comfortable with other ISVs. They were not comfortable with startups. They're not comfortable with digital agencies, with strategy firms, and so on. Now I'm seeing everybody. They're willing to work with everybody.
And of course, Christian Klein is younger than any of us.
That's less. they have some partners in there. They have some executives in the partner ecosystem that have actually been pushing some of that broader thinking.
Again, I appreciate your coming on with us today, Vinny. It's been an interesting discussion.
I've enjoyed it.